Hi, I'm Kate Manchester, and you're listening to Edible Radio. We're here at Edible Institute, and we've got, as I said in previous shows, lots of really interesting people here. And today, I'm going to be talking with writer and photographer Lisa M. Hamilton, whose focus on food and agriculture. She writes the stories of farmers, and her work has taken her from castration time on a Wyoming sheep ranch to a meeting of radical plant breeders in Iowa, from dairy farms in the highlands of Bavaria to sacred rice paddies along the coast of Japan. She's the author of two books, Deeply Rooted, Unconventional Farmers in the Age of Agribusiness, and Farming to Create Heaven on Earth. Her website is lisahamilton.com. And in conversation with Lisa today is Will Harris, and the Harris family of White Oak Pastures has raised cattle on the same early county Georgia farm for five generations. Stewardship of the land and respect for livestock are among the most important core values that have been passed from parent to child. So we've got Lisa Hamilton and Will Harris in conversation today on Edible Radio. Welcome, Lisa, and welcome, Will, to the show. So the first thing I want to ask you guys is how you met, or where you met, or I know there's a story there.
I think about 4 years ago, a mutual friend of ours, Olivia Sargent, runs a farm restaurant in Athens, Georgia, brought me down to meet Will. And as I said, I had no idea what I was getting into. And we went on a day-long tour of the farm. And one of the spots that we hit, and, you know, I'm a sort of a consummate Yankee, born and bred in Boston. And suddenly on this tour, we come to a pond, and Will starts talking about how he used to go swimming there. And tell the story.
Well, my farm's in southwest Georgia, almost Alabama, almost Florida. So we've got kind of an Okefenokee swamp microclimate there, mm-hmm. and a lot of alligators. And this particular fish pond is a pretty good-sized pond, about 16 to 17 acres. And I used to live in a cabin on the pond. And the shower was not real good, so my personal hygiene in the warm months pretty much consisted of, when I get home every day, try to get there before dark, I'd strip off and swim in the pond. And the gators tended to live on the other end of the pond where the water was deep. So, and from the time I would get in the pond, they would come off the bank and start heading my way. But not, I mean, they were very...
Lazy.
Yeah.
It's Georgia, after all.
They weren't like crocodiles in a Tarzan movie.
Oh, my goodness.
They would just kind of languish, swim my way. And I didn't let it bother me much, but at a certain magic point, about 50 feet away, they would all go down.
Oh, yeah.
And that's how I knew it was time to quit swimming.
Get out. Shower's over.
You're as clean as you're going to be at that point.
Well, when I heard the story, I thought, huh, I knew that I was with a different kind of rancher.
Did you go swimming?
Hell no.
No, but they were supposed to go home that night. And we started drinking wine in the pasture, and she and Olivia and their other friend wound up having to spend the night at my house.
Yeah, I love it.
We drank a lot of wine. Mm.
That's great.
Out of Dixie cup.
Mm. Out of Dixie cup, even better. So, Will, I wanted to talk to you a little bit before we start this conversation between the two of you, and I know that as part of Edible Institute, you will be having a conversation this afternoon in front of all of our guests and publishers, but I gave a really brief intro to the Harris Family Heritage and White Oak Pastures, but I mean, it wasn't that long ago that the kind of cattle ranching and selling that you were doing was really more closer to the big ag model than White Oak Pastures is now. So can you tell us how you used to do it, what the transition was and why, and what you're doing now?
Absolutely. We've really come full circle on our farm. My great-grandfather came there after what he called the Northern Invasion, mm-hmm. and raised cattle and sold the beef locally. Every week they butchered a cow and a hog on the farm and locally sold the meat, mm-hmm. where they didn't eat themselves. My grandfather expanded that, still local beef production, still vertically integrated.
Right.
Every day, Monday through Saturday, they killed a cow and two or three hogs and sold the meat, beef or pork locally. World War II occurred on my father's watch, and that's when in our part of the world, the meat industry really industrialized,
right,
and
mm-hmm.
commoditized, and my father brought the business forward to just being part of the industrial meat production system, raising calves, shipping them to the Western feedlots, and
right.
marketed through big beef companies. We started transitioning back over, and I did that as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 55 years old from 1976 when I got out of the University of Georgia until about 1995 or 6. I did that too.
Right.
But at that point, we transitioned over and literally went back to the way my grandfather did, great-grandfather
uh-huh.
did.
Huh. And so why did you do that?
When I graduated from the University of Georgia with my degree in animal science, 23 or whatever years old, very alpha male linear
uh-huh.
southern, you know, it suited me right down to the ground.
Uh-huh.
You know, being able, you know, I weaned my calves at 600 pounds this year. What have you got I can give them to make them weigh more next year? You know, I liked it. I was into that.
The bigger the better.
The bigger the better. That's exactly right. All about pounds.
Uh-huh.
A little about quality. You know, in middle age, that lost its luster.
Right.
And by the time I was 40-something years old, I was just disillusioned with the excesses
right.
of industrial beef production. And when I started reading about sophisticated consumers that wanted to eat meat that was raised differently
mm-hmm.
and eat meat that was raised the way I wanted to do it,
mm-hmm.
then I really, really jumped on that. Emphasis on jumped on it, almost
uh-huh.
to my demise. But but it, you know, that's it was just an opportunity that the timing was right for me. I wanted to do it. People wanted it.
Right.
I did. I was not, you know, had the Mr. Greenspan's irrational exuberance. You know,
yes, indeed.
I misread the difficulty
uh-huh.
in getting that beef from me to the consumer.
Right.
I knew I could raise it that way. I've become convinced that they wanted to buy beef raised that way.
Right.
I really misread how difficult that was going to be, but we've made it through it.
And I think we're glad you did. I think so many of us get into this, you know, field of sustainable food sheds, sustainable agriculture, and we all have this unreasonable exuberance. Thank God. And we all jump into the deep end of the pool without knowing whether or not we can swim, and then, you know, and I've seen a lot of people do that, and I thank God, because if any of us had thought it through from beginning to end, we're already in dire straits, but it would be a lot worse.
Yeah.
You know, the ground is littered with the corpses of those that tried it, and it didn't
right.
work for them.
Right.
I mean, they're thick on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So it's daunting.
Yeah, it is daunting, but well, we're awfully glad you're doing it. Go ahead, Lisa.
Well, you know, one of the things that's remarkable about Will, and there are many, and I don't want to suggest that this is the only remarkable thing, but one of the stumbling blocks of this approach is that, you know, you can, pretty much any cattleman out there can raise a cow to slaughter weight. But it's then, what do you do with it? Where do you get it slaughtered? You know, probably most of the listeners know about, you know, the onerous rules of the USDA about slaughterhouses and, you know, having to have a separate dedicated bathroom for each inspector and so on. Regulations that small-time businesses can rarely meet. And Will has told me about the succession of processing plants that he went through in Georgia, trying to get his vision for or that I guess these pieces that were necessary for manifesting this vision of going back to the way that your grandfather did things. Certainly, he wasn't constrained by USDA regulations, but you were. And after going through a succession of local slaughterhouses, having them not work out, you realized that your only option was to build one yourself. And that's a hell of a big proposition when you sit down and work out the numbers, which I don't know that you did that initially.
At least it's exactly right. Raising, we'll just talk about beef, but I'm going to say pretty much all farm commodities, the way that sophisticated consumers want to buy them with environmental stewardship and animal welfare and the integrity of a local family farmer system in mind is not that difficult. It's a big change, but it's not that difficult. And for many of us, it's what we want to do anyway.
Right.
I mean, it's throw me in that briar patch, Brother Rabbit. That's where we want to be. In the case of beef and meat, the hard part is processing. And I want to be crystal clear on this. I never intended to be a meat processor. I went into this with a very good understanding with a local packing plant, family business, been around for 100 years. And they were going to process my cattle, and they did for some period of time. They had a family dispute that wound up in the dissolution of the business. So they weren't available to me anymore. I found another packer that was 100 miles away, which kind of flew in the face of how I feel about hauling animals. But it was what I had. And I worked with them for several years, and they had limited capacity.
Right.
And as I grew my business, I maxed out their capacity. But I still was not in a position where I was profitable. I mean, I was all they could do, but it wasn't enough head per week to allow my business to be profitable.
Right.
So I tried very, very hard to get them to expand. I tried to get other people to build a processing plant. We explored some cooperatives. You know, it just wasn't going to work. So we finally, you know, kicking and screaming, made up our mind to build a plant, and we did. We built a USDA inspected packing plant on my farm. There are only two on farm USDA beef plants in the country, ours and one in California. It cost $2.2 million.
Wow!
And you know, we had some very dismal days, not just building it, but in terms of cash flowing it. After we got it built. Now, we're okay now. But I had a lot of moments where, what in the hell was you thinking?
You said something funny before. I was commenting that that this was a ballsy move that Will had made. And he said, well, if I had thought about it, it would have been ballsy, but I didn't know what the hell
that's
I was
the
doing.
Thing.
It's always just plain stupid.
Yeah. Well, and then sometimes I you know what? Story of my life, diving into the deep end, going, what the hell was I thinking? But this is great. So now, and what you're talking about is one of the things that, you know, this is one of the problems, just one of the, you know, grab bag of problems that you see all over the country. And that is, you know, it's several stages. So you maxed out the plant that you were using to slaughter your now healthy grass-fed beef, you're still not profitable. Not too many farmers, ranchers can afford, and we're facing the same problem here in New Mexico. I've got one guy up down in Galisteo, he'll be here today, Tim Wilms, who is doing lambs, turkeys, and rabbits. He bought himself a slaughterhouse, and of course he can't do the poultry. But again, it's kind of getting it to capacity. Mm-hmm. And right now, we have enough protein in New Mexico to feed all of New Mexico probably 3 or 4 times. It all leaves the state. Mm-hmm. And I think something less than 7% stays here in New Mexico just to feed New Mexico and forget about slaughtering and processing here in New Mexico. So that's a big key piece that's, you know,
Well, and something that's so striking as a contrast to this conversation that we're having, you know, talking about Will maxing out the plant that he was working with, you think about that in contrast to the processing plants run by Tyson and JBS and so on, doing what, 100, 200?
400 head an hour.
400 head an hour. I mean, that's the scale that... that you're working on is so vastly different. The idea that the USDA regulations are virtually the same is astonishing. And that's to me what makes this so remarkable is that Will, whether he was conscious of the risk or not, dove into it and said, you know, I want to do this enough that I'm willing to not only kind of go against my own will, but also go against reason and economics to do it, and has made it work and is now making a profit of it.
Mm-hmm. I should say that our plant only does about 100 head a week. So it's as compared to
very
large industrial
scale
plant that does 400 head an hour, mm-hmm. maybe 16 hours a day, maybe 7 days a week. So mm-hmm. the economies of scale are just absolutely upside down. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so my next question is, okay, so you're profitable. That's fantastic. How many markets do you have? It's the brand is White Oak Pastures, is that correct?
That's correct.
And so how many markets do you have, and how is the... What about the consumer side? What's the consumer demand been? I mean, is it exceeding or... Talk about that a little bit.
Consumer demand is very good, and I believe it's growing. I believe that the economic recession probably caused it to level out a little bit, but I don't think it caused it to diminish.
Uh-huh.
And I mentioned earlier on that the hard part was after you produce it, getting it to the consumer.
Uh-huh.
While consumer demand is good, even after it's processed, it's hard to get it to them. We have a little website with a mail order business, but I'm not a great advocate of selling meat through the mail. I mean,
right.
I do it, but in my
right.
mind, it lends itself to that more poorly than any other product I can think of.
I think you're probably right about
but,
that.
But there's a lot of it done, and we do a little of it. My biggest customer is Whole Foods Market.
Uh-huh.
And if it weren't for Whole Foods, I don't know where we would be. I mean, it's absolutely the only venue that I've found that will get enough beef through my plant to make it work. But they have given us distribution in three of their regions, the Florida region, the South region, and the Mid-Atlantic region.
Mm-hmm.
Publix Supermarkets is a very good customer of ours in the Deep South.
Interesting.
A food service company called Buckhead Beef, which is a Sysco company,
uh-huh.
sells our beef into food service. And then there's some small organic distributors, Destiny Organics and Tree of Life, who were my first customers. Mm-hmm. It's like the first girl who went to the dance, will you?
You
know, you always appreciate that.
That's know? Right.
The difficulty is, I'll tell you a little story. When I first got ready to sell my beef, got my USDA label and got my grass right and my genetics right, and I thought I was ready to rock and roll, I got an appointment with the head meat buyer for Publix in Lakeland, Florida. Great guy, retired now, named John Telford. And he gave me the meeting as a favor to a friend. And I went in there and told him what I wanted to do. And the whole time I was talking, he was shaking his head. And when I got through, he said, "You have no idea how far you are from being where you want to be, and I don't think you can make it."
Wow.
And I said, "Tell me." He said, "You know, you got to have UPC barcoding, product liability insurance, website, you know, on all kind of stuff. Just a list." And I wrote it all down. And he was right. I didn't have any of that stuff. But we went back. I went back. And over the next 2 years, we got it. Every bit of it. And he gave me another appointment. And I went back. And he bought my beef. And we've been selling
wow.
Publix ever since.
Wow. Yeah,
but he, you know, he spoon-fed me. I mean, he really, mm-hmm. he really told me what I had to do and took, you know, getting UPC barcoding is not a big deal if you're a big food company and you can just, you know, call somebody from down the hall in that department to do it. But, you know, I was the only guy down the hall.
Right. So. Right.
Well, I wonder if you would tell us, you know, what we've done so far is describe, you know, a handful of hurdles and how huge they were and your spirit in overcoming them. But I know that there's something more than just your own sort of can-do or, you know, caution-to-the-wind attitude that propelled you through overcoming these hurdles. What's motivating you through all this?
Several things. You know, from I mentioned earlier I had a growing dissatisfaction with producing beef the way I was producing it. The next thing is, you know, my family has raised cattle on that farm for 144 years, and I have three daughters, and it was important to me to create the opportunity for them to stay there if they wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't just not want them to do it the way I'd been doing it. I didn't think they could. I mean, it's a very hard business.
So you didn't think they could, and I'm sensing on other levels, not just that it's hard work, but...
Oh, no. Not just hard work. It's a very hard business. Very, uh-huh. You know, there's an adversarial relationship in the chain.
Mm-hmm.
From the cow-calf farmer to the feedlot operator to the packer to the grocery distributor.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a hard business with everybody competing for every penny of margin. Mm-hmm. And to be successful in that, it's a very hard business. You, mm-hmm. you know, I don't think my daughters are equipped.
Right.
To compete with that.
And I also think, you know, this is going to sound terribly sexist, but I think, you know, just listening to you and watching your body language describe the chain, this is not what, it's not what women do.
Mm. Well, and furthermore, I think you recognize that what your daughters, and particularly your middle daughter, was very well equipped to do was to sort of take on the... sort of the soft business, the business that's built on relationships,
mm-hmm.
and to tell your story and to make sort of the history of your farm and the values of your farm matter in a way that probably, I don't know, if just, you know, your average rancher's son out in Bluffton, Georgia might not be.
Well, I don't think we should make it sexist because I think men or women, it doesn't matter. What's important here is, in this food production system, what's important is to produce a product that has added value, that's a premium product,
mm-hmm.
that a sophisticated consumer can choose to pay more for it,
mm-hmm.
and with that premium they pay, the farmer can live and reinvest in the land and the herd and add more value. Whereas in the industrial model, it's all about balls to the wall production
right.
of pounds of beef
right.
and commodity trading. You know, you don't really work harder to add value. You work to meet the minimum standards. You know, it's USDA number 2 yellow corn. You know, that was a time, let's get off beef. There was a time when farmers produced corn and wheat that was milled. It had their name on it. It
right.
had White Oak Pastures corn or wheat. And it was important to them to put value in that bag so that miller would come back to White Oak Pastures and pay more for it. Well, in the industrial system, USDA establishes minimums that you just got to get above. And then you're going to get the same thing for it, no matter how much value you put in. And the quickest way to go broke is add a lot of extra value that you're going to sell on a commodity market.
But you just you made a really, really important point here. And, you know, so years ago when you had these people selling cornmeal or flour with their name on it, the thing that they had established with the public was a relationship. Mm. People trusted a brand. They trusted a name. There was some integrity there. And that's the thing that's missing in commodity. In commodity, anything, I think the integrity is gone. And the relationships are gone. Mm-hmm. You know, now, you know, we don't know where the beef is coming from. We don't know where the corn is coming from. Even though it's supposed to be labeled, it's not. Mm-hmm. And there's, not only is the system badly damaged and in need of repair, but all of the integrity is gone. And all of the trust is gone.
Well, and what's really a shame, as I've seen in my work, is that just because someone is a commodity, is selling to the commodity market, doesn't mean that there's not integrity there. And
right.
I think, as you know, Will said before, among beef ranchers, he knows, I think it's true for, you know, whether you're a corn farmer or, a, you know, raising spinach in the Salinas Valley or what have you, there are a lot of people out there who want to not only maintain integrity, but increase it. But there simply isn't a place for, valuing that in the commodity market.
Right.
Something that Will and I were talking about a bit before is this idea of somehow creating a new set of values by which farmers and ranchers can assess their success. I mean, right now, Once you meet those minimum quality standards set by the USDA, if you're, say, a corn farmer, all that matters is how much you produce. There is no other measure for the success of your work. And there are so many other pieces that actually matter: the health of your land, the health of your community, the health of your own family, your own
right.
sanity.
Right.
And it's a real tall order to create that new set of values. But if we had that, the economics of agriculture, I think, would look vastly, vastly different.
You know, and things have become tweaked and tweaked and tweaked until almost all of us have lost sight of what's important. You know, core values of my family have always been, since my great-grandfather was there, you take care of the land and the cows, and they'll take care of you.
Right.
We believe that every single generation, even when we weren't doing it. You know, we didn't decide to heck with animal welfare and environmental stewardship. We're just going to make pounds of beef. We still believe we were taking care of the land and the cows. The fact is, I went to the University of Georgia and learned how to use hormone implants and subtherapeutic antibiotics in feeds and confinement feeding of corn and soy. And that's what we were taught to do, and it produced a lot of beef. I never thought I wasn't taking care of the land and the cows. I was using copious quantities of chemical fertilizer and pesticides. I was confinement feeding cattle. But if you asked me, I would have said, you take care of the land and the cows, and they'll take care of you. Because it happened gradually.
Right.
And my family wouldn't have survived had we not made that transition to industrialization. Had we, had my father continued, you know, to hell with it, I'm going to keep raising cattle in this humane, in this system in which you don't make many pounds of beef, but it's very, you know, environmentally sustainable, and the animal welfare is great, he'd gone broke.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he there was no market for him to sell into in 1976, 78.
Right.
You know, until a consumer decided, that's not what I want to eat anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I want to eat something that's done differently. I couldn't, my family nor anyone else's family could add that value and sell it in the commodity market. So it occurred slowly and gradually. Mm-hmm. And we were taught that in the land-grant university. And, you know, how could that be wrong? But
Your tax dollars.
Yes, at work.
Hard at work.
better living through chemicals.
Well, this brings up something else that I've been thinking about, Will. Bluffton, Georgia, as you said, is in that is right close to Alabama and to Florida. It's not certainly not in the hub of sort of sustainable agriculture activity. There is not bound to be an edible Bluffton anytime soon. And my sense is that your goal within your community is not to build a local foods system. That's too much for one man to handle. I wonder what you would say is your goal within your community.
Well, my goal may be to build a system, but it's not to convince my friends and neighbors and relatives that grass-fed beef and organic carrots are better, because that's not going to happen for the most part in my lifetime. You know, Bluffton is a town of 32 people. It's a purely agrarian economy, all agrarian economy. Mm-hmm. A lot of poor people. It sits halfway between Columbus, Georgia, and Tallahassee, Florida, which are trade centers. Halfway between Dothan, Alabama, and Albany, Georgia, which are trade centers. It's 50 miles from the nearest Walmart. And when I say that, I'm bragging. It's hard to do that east of the Mississippi. but it's a negative externality for most people in that part of the world. So my goal has not been and is not to convince those people to eat differently, because you know, that's not who it would. Mm-hmm. But there is an opportunity for this kind of agriculture. I call it LASH, local, artisan, sustainable, humane.
Uh-huh.
For LASH food production to have an enormous economic impact in Bluffton, Georgia, and many other towns across the country. At our little farm, we own 1,000 acres of land and lease about that much more. We employ 27 people. That's mm-hmm. the farm and the plant. Nobody makes minimum wage, and some of them make good five-digit salaries. And that's a big economic impact in Bluffton, Georgia. I got friends that farm 6,000 or 7,000 acres of land with 3 minimum wage employees, but it's industrial commodity production.
Right.
So rural America has been poorly served by industrial agriculture.
Huh.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I would also add that a number of those employees are at the slaughterhouse. If you think about the, you know, since I know that social justice is becoming a real part of this conversation, you think about the experience of the workers at the JBS plant, Tyson plant, where they're processing 400 animals an hour, the experience of that versus the 20-odd people who work at your plant in Bluffton, Georgia, doing 100 head a week. That's a very different experience and a very different kind of commitment to or relationship with the community of people who work for you.
Well, I think it's just a better system. I think that if our beef is better than industrial beef, if it is, one of the reasons is because of the people that process it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the folks that work in my plant are not transient migrant people. At a big industrial plant, they strive for zero training. You know, just stand there and make one procedure all day, every day. The people at my plant are artisan meat cutters. They've learned how to do it all. And I'm told that at big industrial plants, they strive to hold turnover to 100% a year.
Wow.
That's why they strive for zero training. Well, at my plant, you know, everybody there, I think, likes their job. It's a career for them. I like every one of them. I think they like me most days. Some days maybe not. And I think they care about white oak pastures beef. If they see something that doesn't look right, they go and get my plant manager, who has a master's degree in meat science from the University of Florida. In a big industrial plant, you know, the chain is speeding by.
Mm.
And I'm probably not going to be here tomorrow anyway. So, you know, I think that that's one of the things that has an impact on our quality.
Right.
Well, and I would say one more added benefit of setting up the system this way is that you, as sort of the person who is going to bear the risk. You can trust the people who are working in that plant, and you can trust the person who's managing it so that you can be back out on the land, which is where you want to be in the first place.
Never wanted to be a meat plant owner. That wasn't in the green plan.
Yeah.
But you know, it is. But my name is on every piece of meat that leaves there, and it needs to be right.
Right. I want to thank both of you for being here. I feel like we could have a much longer conversation, and I hope that we do have the opportunity to have a much longer conversation. I'm thrilled that you're both able to come, and I want to thank you both so much.
Thank you.
And we'll talk again soon, I know.
Thank you for having us.
To learn more about Edible Radio or Edible Communities, visit us at ediblecommunities.com.